So good morning, everyone. I hope you all slept well and your retreat is going well so far. So what we're going to do this morning and for the next few morning sessions actually is offer some insight practices which are taken from the Satipatthana Sutta. So what's the Satipatthana Sutta? Well, you may well have heard of it already, but if you haven't, the Satipatthana Sutta is essentially a kind of anthology of practices. The name is, well, Satipatthana, the sati part is mindfulness, awareness, paying attention to things. Upatthana is the last part, and it means something like placing near or attending. So Satipatthana Sutta might mean something like the discourse on attending with mindfulness. You sometimes hear it called the four foundations of mindfulness. There's a technical Pali thing there. Apparently, if you parse it out as patana rather than upatthana, then you get foundations instead. Yeah, there's a whole big thing. Doesn't really matter. There's four categories of mindfulness practices, which is where you get four foundations of mindfulness. And we're going to start at the beginning and work our way through over the next few mornings. One other interesting historical thing about this discourse is that it looks like it's had various bits added onto it as time has gone on. It's a big collection of practices. There's different versions of it in different canons. Different traditions have preserved their own versions of the suttas, and each tradition has a slightly different version of this discourse. And if you sort of compare all of them, you can see there's a few practices which show up in every single version of it. So they're probably the oldest ones. They're probably the original ones. And then as time has gone on, people in each tradition have thought, oh, actually, this is another mindfulness practice, and that's pretty good as well. Let's just lob it into the Satipatthana Sutta. And so over time, it expands to become this kind of encyclopedia of practices. And so we're going to have a look at some of those practices. Like I said yesterday, I think there are quite a lot of practices in this discourse. And so, yeah, I'll be throwing a lot of information at you over the coming mornings. For those of you who have practiced with Satipatthana before, I'll be including some details and sort of variations and tweaks and things, a lot of which come from Anália's book on the Satipatthana Sutta, which is well worth reading if you haven't read it. So if you're experienced with Satipatthana already, there'll be some details as we go through that might give you some new angles to explore and play with to give you a fresh look at some of these practices. If you haven't worked with these practices before, then don't worry too much about the myriad details that I'll be throwing out there. I know some people like details. I'm sorry, with me you get details. That's just how it works. But for each of the practices, try to come away with the core of the practice, the spirit of what it's getting at. And then you can play with that in any way that you want to. So without further ado, let us start the text. It begins, "Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Kuru country, at a town of the Kurus named Kamasadama. There he addressed the monks thus, 'Monks, venerable sir,' they replied. The Blessed One said this, 'Monks, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method, for the realization of nibbana, namely the four Satipatthanas.'" So, quite a bit in there already. It begins, "Thus have I heard," and as you may well know, Buddhism was preserved as an oral tradition for a long time. So the idea was that people memorized the discourses and then taught them to the next generation, who then taught them to the next generation. It was repeated down and down and down. And so they tend to begin, "Thus have I heard," because, yeah, this is the way I heard it. This is the person I learned this discourse from. This is what they told me. Discourses then also often begin with a little bit of a context setting. We get to hear where the Buddha was, who he was talking to, what the audience was. And that's quite important information sometimes. the Buddha didn't just have a one-size-fits-all teaching. He didn't just say, you know, the power of now or whatever, and he just said the same thing to everyone he ever met. The Buddha knew a great deal about the spiritual traditions and practices of his time and would very often vary what he was saying so that he could speak to people in a language they could more easily understand, rather than having to start by teaching people a whole lexicon of terms before we could even get going. And in this case, the audience is a group of monks, and that usually means that the teachings are going to be a little deeper, a little more technical compared to teachings given to lay people, because at the time, the people who were serious about their spiritual practice would become monks or nuns, and householders were too busy doing household life things to really have too much time for practice. In the modern day, things are a little bit different, right? As far as I can tell, none of you are monks or nuns. You seem to have too much hair for that. I'm certainly not a monk, nor have I ever been. We live in an interesting time, right, where deep practices are accessible to householders and to people who are willing to put in the effort, whether they live in a monastery or somewhere else. It's important to say that these practices are available to everyone. You don't need to be monastic, you don't need to be a man, you don't need to be anything in particular. My Zen teacher likes to say that the only real qualification for this stuff is that you want to do it. And yeah, you've all signed up for this retreat, so you've passed that test already. So yeah, I've tweaked the translation as we go on to omit references to monks and to make things gender neutral, just to underscore the fact that although this was directed to a particular audience, these practices can be done by anyone who has an interest in them. If you aren't interested in the practices, then I can't help you. So then he goes on to say this interesting thing. This is the direct path for the purification of beings. And the words used there literally translate as a one-going path. And there's been all kinds of debate about what exactly this means. And there seem to be five major interpretations, of which I like two of them and I'm not so keen on the others, but I'll put them all out there and see what you make of them. Satipatthana can be seen as a direct path in the sense that it's a path that leads straight to the goal. You don't spend years doing prostrations before you start meditating or anything like that. It's pretty much, yeah, we're going to practice some mindfulness, and if we practice mindfulness well enough, that will move us in the direction of nibbana. It could be viewed as, so if we interpret it as a one-going path, we could look at that as a path that one walks alone. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have teachers or spiritual friends, we don't have a sangha, we don't have people to help us along the way, but it means that it's a path that we each have to walk for ourselves. As much as I might like to, I can't meditate for all 36 of you. To be honest, that sounds pretty exhausting anyway, so I'm not sure I'd want to. But you each have to do the work for yourself. You have to bring yourself to your practice, to find a way in, to find a way to engage with it, to do the work for yourself. The third interpretation is that this is a path taught by the one true teacher, which means the Buddha, not Neo from the Matrix. You often find these kinds of things starting to creep into spiritual traditions as time goes on. You know, Buddhism is clearly better than Jainism, and here's six examples of when the Buddha trounced the Jains in debates and all that kind of stuff. As Lee says, clearly the Buddha was a kind of genius, right? There's a truly remarkable body of teachings that came down from this person. But I don't personally like the exclusionary quality of that, the idea that, you know, Buddhism and particularly early Buddhism has all the good stuff and everything else is just wrong. I think there's good stuff in all kinds of places, actually. I think it's useful to be open to wisdom wherever we can find it. Which leads on to the fourth interpretation, which is that this is a path found only in the one true way of Buddhism. Yeah, okay, fine, whatever. And the fifth one is that this is a path leading to the one goal of nibbana, the direction that the spiritual path is ultimately pointing us to. We can have all kinds of interesting things happen along the way as we do our practice. We can have interesting experiences, we can learn skills, we can cultivate qualities and whatnot. But fundamentally, the Buddha's path was about the road to nibbana. And that's what this discourse is all about. So we have this direct path, namely the four Sati Patthanas. The discourse continues. What are the four? Here, in regard to the body, one abides contemplating the body. Diligent, clearly knowing and mindful. Free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. In regard to feelings, one abides contemplating feelings. Diligent, clearly knowing and mindful. Free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. In regard to the mind or mind states, one abides contemplating the mind. Diligent, clearly knowing and mindful. Free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. And in regard to dharmas, one abides contemplating dharmas. Diligent, clearly knowing and mindful. Free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. So we have these four subcategories within the discourse. There's the body, that's this thing here, this meat creature thing that follows us around wherever we go. There's a whole lot of body-based practices. We're going to look at a bunch of those. Next, we have feelings. Lee has already touched on this. So the word being translated here is Vedana. And it's the sense that whatever comes up in our experience, we find it pleasant, we find it unpleasant, or we find it neither pleasant nor unpleasant, somewhere in the middle, neutral. So the second part, the second category, the second Satipatthana, is about essentially the way things feel to us. Are they pleasant? Are they unpleasant? Are they neutral? The third category, mind, is about mind states. And the fourth category, dharmas, phenomena, teachings, aspects of the Buddhist path. Again, Lee has touched on this a little bit, and we'll get into a lot more detail as we reach each of the sections along the way, so I won't spend too much time on that now. Instead, let's just dive straight in to the first Satipatthana, the section on the body. So, first practice. And how does one, in regard to the body, abide contemplating the body? Here, gone to the forest, or to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut, one sits down. Having folded one's legs crosswise, set one's body erect, and established mindfulness in front of oneself, mindful one breathes in, mindful one breathes out. So we're describing mindfulness of breathing, a practice which is familiar to us all at this point, I think. A few key points here. The first is to find an appropriate place for practice. It's good to be in a place where we can really focus on what we're doing, where we don't have lots of distractions. Depending on the specific practice we're doing, that may mean that we can tolerate a more noisy environment or a less noisy one. But yeah, we want to make sure we're in an appropriate place that we can really dig into the practice that we're trying to do. The next thing is the posture. And as I'm reading this, I'm realizing I'm starting to slouch in my chair, so I'm just going to sit up a little bit. So, posture. We want a posture that balances stability, relaxation on the one hand, with alertness, awakeness on the other. It's good to have a straight back. It's good to have alignment in the body rather than being hunched, slumped, or crumpled. And then establish mindfulness. Breathe and know that you're breathing. And it can be as simple as that. That can be a very simple mindfulness of breath practice. Breathe and know that you're breathing. But the discourse doesn't stop there. It goes on to give a few more instructions. Breathing in long, one knows I breathe in long. Breathing out long, one knows I breathe out long. Breathing in short, one knows I breathe in short. Breathing out short, one knows I breathe out short. One trains thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body. One trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body. One trains thus, I shall breathe in, calming the bodily formation. One trains thus, I shall breathe out, calming the bodily formation. So those of you who've worked with the Anapanasati Sutta will recognize these as the first four steps of Anapanasati. I'm not going to talk very much about Anapanasati because I haven't practiced that much with it myself. If you do want to talk about that, Lee has done a lot more work with that than I have, so please address your questions to him. But the key here is that we're not just, oh yeah, I'm breathing in, I'm breathing out, fine. We're not just kind of trying to nail our attention to the breath and just kind of hope something useful happens. There's a sense here of paying attention to the details of the experience. So if we're taking a long breath, we know it's a long breath. We have enough awareness of what's going on to have a sense that, yeah, this is a long breath. And likewise, if it's a short breath. Long and short here might also mean deeper and more shallow. As you're getting concentrated, you may be noticing the breath is starting to get more shallow. We talked about that earlier on. So again, it's noticing the details of the breath. Is the breath long or short, deep or shallow? It's getting into kind of really sinking the attention, soaking the attention into what's going on, really noticing the fine details, the textures of what's happening, not just breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, because there's only so much insightful that can come from a very sort of a very conceptual relationship to the breath. You know, if we're only really aware of the breath insofar as, yeah, I know when I'm breathing in, I know when I'm breathing out, and that's kind of about as far as it goes, there's probably not enough there to really find much insight from it. But as we start to get more into the details, the physical sensations, the textures of the breath, the experience becomes richer, more interesting. There's more to explore. Then the next couple of parts are interesting because we're getting into the territory of multiple different interpretations for things. So like I mentioned, this is a really interesting discourse. It's got a lot of practices in it. It's been central to the practice of many traditions and sub-traditions over a couple of thousand years. And so people have strong views about how to interpret the language. The discourse itself often just doesn't really say what it means. It just throws out a word and, you know, if you know what the word means, then good for you. And if you don't, then it doesn't really help that much. And the commentaries will say, oh yeah, this means this and this means that. And sometimes you look at the commentaries and you think, yeah, that's quite reasonable. And sometimes you look at the commentaries and you think, really? Are you sure? And there's plenty of competing interpretations for many of these practices. If you have studied with other teachers who have different interpretations of the practices, then, well, sorry, this is a thing that happens. Where I am aware of multiple useful interpretations of the practices, I'll often give those, actually. My interest is not on settling on the one true version of each practice. That's what the Buddha really taught. I'm more interested in, is this a useful practice? Does it lead somewhere that's interesting, that's worthwhile? If so, then I consider it to be valid, whether or not it's what the Buddha really meant 2,500 years ago. To each their own. So when it comes to training oneself thus, I shall breathe in experiencing the whole body, and I shall breathe out experiencing the whole body. One way of interpreting that is that it's about the whole physical body. So as I breathe, I'm mindful of what's happening in my whole physical body. So it's not just a very precise focus at one point of the breath, but it's a sense of the body as a whole. It's a more broad, expansive kind of mindfulness that's anchored in the body as a whole. That is an interesting and valid way to practice. Another interpretation is that in this context, the word body means the body of the breath. And that means the entirety of the breath. So when you breathe, the in-breath begins, and then there's a middle to it, and then there's an end, and then there's a gap. And then as you breathe out, there's a beginning, a middle, an end, and a gap. So there's this kind of arc, this wave of breath. And we can interpret this as meaning that, yeah, we should be interested in the whole breath as it flows along, staying with it continuously, rather than just kind of touching in with it from time to time and then going back to mind wandering and then coming back and, oh, yep, still breathing, and then wandering back and forth. And then we have this instruction, I shall breathe in, calming the bodily formation, I shall breathe out, calming the bodily formation. So this can be interpreted as doing something intentional to use the breath to try to calm the body. I would suggest probably not doing that. I would suggest letting the breath do whatever the breath wants to do. But there's a couple of things. One is that as we stay in the practice, as we settle, as we get more concentrated, you'll find actually that the mind and body settle quite naturally. You don't really need to do anything to make that happen. You just need to not shake it up even more. So as you breathe and you notice how the breath changes and how the body changes, you might start to see some of that relationship between breath and body and calmness developing. The second thing is that intention is really important in practice. If we have the intention that as we're breathing, our body is calming, we don't have to necessarily breathe in a particular way, in a special way. We don't have to do pranayama or anything like that. But simply by holding the intention that as we breathe, the body will settle, I'll actually encourage the body to settle. So next in the discourse is a simile. And we have similes for many of the practices, which give us a sense in what would have been everyday language at the time of the Buddha. Some of it hasn't aged that well, but what would have been everyday language for the kinds of things that are being described. So we've had some details for the mindfulness of breathing practice that really emphasize, yeah, paying attention to the specifics, the fine details of what's going on in the breath. And then we have this simile. Just as a skilled turner or their apprentice, when making a long turn, knows I make a long turn, or when making a short turn, knows I make a short turn, so too, breathing in long, one knows I breathe in long, and so on and so forth. So this is an image of someone who is doing woodwork and doing it with diligence and care. They're not just kind of banging something out that's going to come out any old funny shape and that's that. This is somebody who's focused on their work. They're trying to create a particular effect. They're trying to get somewhere in particular. And so the details matter. It's important whether it's a long turn or a short. I mean, I don't know turning. I don't know woodworking. I don't know how this works. But you know, if you're doing your woodworking, then it matters a lot, right? You know, exactly how hard you press and where you're working and all that kind of thing. It's the difference between producing a beautiful sculpture and producing an ugly mass of chunks of wood, right? So paying attention with diligence and care is what's being described here. Then we have the refrain. And if the Satipatthana Sutta were a song, then the refrain would be the chorus. It's the bit that we come back to after each of the practices. And here's how it goes. In this way, in regard to the body, one abides contemplating the body internally, or one abides contemplating the body externally, or one abides contemplating the body both internally and externally. One abides contemplating the nature of arising in the body, or one abides contemplating the nature of passing away in the body, or one abides contemplating the nature of both arising and passing away in the body. Mindfulness that there is a body is established in oneself to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. And one abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how, in regard to the body, one abides contemplating the body. So, this is the part where, if you are allergic to details, yeah, this is going to get detail-y. Because we can look at the refrain as suggesting refinements for the practice. If what you want to do is work with mindfulness of the breath, pay attention to the the texture of the breath, as I was saying earlier, and just not worry too much about the stuff in the refrain, that's fine. But like I say, if you've done a bunch of mindfulness of breathing, then there's a few suggestions here that are really interesting to bring into your practice. So first of all, we have the first kind of trio of suggestions here, contemplating the body internally, externally, and both internally and externally. So this can be interpreted in a couple of ways. One interpretation is that the body internally means sort of inside the body, and externally means the surface of the body, like the skin. So it's about mindfulness of what's going on deep within versus on the surface. Yeah, that's an interesting way to practice. It's completely valid for sure. Particularly if you've done things like energy work and you can get a sense of subtle body phenomena versus more gross physical body phenomena, then bringing mindfulness to one or the other or both of those can be an interesting thing to do. Another way of viewing this, though, and one which I would say maps on better to the same refrain showing up in all of the practices throughout the whole rest of the discourse, is to look at it as pointing towards universality. So we start with mindfulness of the body internally, with my body, mine, this thing here. This is the most important body in the world, right? Because it's mine, it's the important one. So we start with mindfulness of my body and explore that in some detail. Then we turn the attention outward and become mindful of other bodies, humans, animals, birds, the whole works. And yeah, we can be mindful of the bodies of other beings as well. This is particularly helpful if you're on retreat and you're in the meditation hall with that one person with the noisy breathing. Yeah, you can be mindful of their breath instead of your own. And then the third step is mindfulness both internally and externally. So this is where we get into this sort of universal quality. I have a body, you have a body, we all have bodies. I breathe, you breathe, we all breathe together. Breathing is not something that makes me special. Breathing is something that is a natural part of life. As we start exploring some of the three characteristics, we start asking questions like, who exactly am I and what is my relationship with the world? We quite often find that there's a sense that the bit in the middle of our experience, this bit here, me, is the most important bit, and then everything else is somewhat less important. So it's kind of like I'm up here and then everything else kind of down there, further out. The more that we start looking to see actually what we have in common with everyone and everything else, which turns out to be basically everything, the more it starts to erode that sense of specialness in the middle, the more it starts to put us on the same level as everyone and everything else. It starts to dissolve the sense of separateness between me, the most important thing in the world, and everything else that's going on. So, yeah, notice your own breath, the breath of others, notice the universal quality of breath. Then we have another trio which takes a similar format, but this time around impermanence. So it says, one abides contemplating the nature of arising in the body. So yeah, notice the very beginning of the in-breath, the very beginning of the out-breath. Notice that moment where the breath sensations begin. Where do they come from? Do you get any warning, or does it just ping into existence? What's going on there? One abides contemplating the nature of passing away in the body. Look at the ends of sensations, the end of the in-breath, the end of the out-breath. Where do the sensations go when they vanish? What's going on there? And then one abides contemplating the nature of both arising and passing away in the body. So we've zeroed in on arisings, we've zeroed in on passings, and now we can start to look at impermanence more generally, the coming and going nature of things. As you look at the breath, is there actually a thing called the breath, or is the breath composed of smaller sensations? Is there anything that's continuous or solid or fixed in there? Is there anything that is identifiably the breath at all? Or is it fluxing, flowing, transitory sensations? I've phrased that in quite a leading way, but don't take my word for it. You'll want to explore all of these things for yourself. Investigate. Keep investigating, really see what's going on. And then we have this instruction that mindfulness that there is a body is established in oneself to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. So, to the extent necessary, how much mindfulness is enough? Lee has introduced this idea of relaxed diligence, and that goes for insight practice just as much as for concentration practice. If we're trying too hard, if we're focusing to the point that the mind is getting tight, that's actually counterproductive and will tend to result in restlessness. This can be a vicious cycle because we start getting restless and we think, oh, I really need to try harder and get less restless and really focus. And yeah, that will introduce more energy into the system and make you even more restless. So there's definitely a place and time for dialing things down a bit. Conversely, though, we can dial things down far enough that we fall asleep. That's not that useful either. If things are becoming dull and drowsy and sleepy, then yeah, we may need to brighten things up and actually bring a bit more energy into what's going on. So how much mindfulness is enough? Well, you've got to find that out for yourself, right? But I can't say 7 and have that be a meaningful amount of mindfulness. You've got to work out for yourself. Also be aware that this will be a moving target. As the retreat goes on, as you settle, as the practice goes deeper, the amount of energy that you need may change, actually. It may be that you can use less effort and as a result, see subtler qualities of what's going on. So even if you found, you know, the perfect Goldilocks amount of mindfulness today, it might be different tomorrow. And then to the extent necessary for bare knowledge. So Lee's already mentioned that when we're doing our samadhi practice, when we're doing jhanas, we may have stuff come up. Psychological material can bubble up from the depths. Ordinarily, I think we're spending a certain amount of unconscious energy keeping that stuff buried. And as more of our energy becomes focused and unified into our samadhi practice, that stuff can now start to bubble up to the surface. Same thing can absolutely happen in insight practice, where, you know, maybe we set out to investigate the impermanence of the breath sensations, and then suddenly we find ourselves thinking about that toxic boss that we had in our last job or whatever it might be. So generally speaking, with insight practice, insight meditation, we're interested not so much in the content of our experience, but in the nature of our experience. So if we're looking at something like the three characteristics, if we're looking at impermanence, then it's not really that interesting or relevant exactly what our toxic boss did to us in the career. What might be interesting is to notice the impermanence of the thoughts and memories that are coming and going. Notice that they're just like everything else. They're just like the breath sensations. They have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And you can see the stuff coming and going. The trouble is that with thoughts, they're quite sticky, and particularly with emotionally charged stories, they can really pull us in. So if we're doing something like mindfulness of breathing, then yeah, to the extent that we can stay with the breath sensations rather than whatever might be bubbling up in the head, and to the extent that we can really look at the nature of these sensations, we can investigate the impermanence or whatever it is that we're looking at. That will really help with to deepen the insight practice. That being said, sometimes stuff comes up and you just got to deal with it, and you got to do what you got to do. And we also have this suggestion that we should do things to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. Continuity of practice is very important, whether you're doing samadhi, whether you're doing insight work. If you're trying to get concentrated, then yeah, you really need to be staying with that concentration practice consistently. And I'll say a bit more about that later on when we talk about one of the other practices. But it's the same for insight, actually. If you think about what Lee said about right view right at the beginning of the retreat, the idea here is that right now, the way we see the world is potentially not the optimal way we could be seeing it. It's a way of seeing the world that works well enough on one level, but brings a certain amount of dukkha with it. And the suggestion is that we can come to see the world a different way, which, yeah, doesn't have so much dukkha associated with it. That means that in order to get there, we're going to have to change the way we see the world. Now, we've had a lifetime of practicing the way we see it currently. So we've really kind of, we've really got the muscle memory for that. We've really bedded that in. And our minds are not going to start seeing things differently just on a whim, just because we say so. If they were, then we'd all be in right view already. So what we need to do is essentially gather evidence, Right. Insight practice challenges some of our deeply held beliefs about how things work, that we live in a permanent, dependable world of separate things. And the suggestion is that by doing our insight practice, we'll find out that actually all of those things are pretty questionable. But it's not enough to see it once. It's not enough to spend 5 minutes looking at the impermanence of the breath and boom, you no longer see a world of solid things anymore. Insight practice is kind of a process of gathering evidence bit by bit, little by little challenging those underlying unconscious worldviews and saying, yeah, actually, maybe not. Maybe it's not like that. The more I look, the more I see, no, it really isn't. And then at some point, we'll have amassed enough of a sort of critical mass of evidence for a new way of seeing things that will slide over. So continuous mindfulness, continuity of practice, very, very important. Now, I said a little bit about this yesterday, but I'll just touch into it again, because I'm always conscious that we start out by offering mindfulness of breathing as in the context of a concentration practice, right? We're using it as an access method, many of us. And now we're talking about mindfulness of breathing again, but now it's in an insight context. The object of meditation is the same in both cases. We're working with the breath. But the intention that we're bringing to the practice is different depending on whether we're interested in samadhi or whether we're interested in insight. If we're working with the breath for the purposes of samadhi, then our interest is in stability, in one-pointed attention, in settling our attention onto the breath and just staying there. So we're actually not terribly interested in details like impermanence. In fact, in some ways, paying too much attention to impermanence in a samadhi context is unhelpful because we're trying to stabilize the mind. And if we're at the same time trying to notice how unstable it is, then that's kind of counterproductive. So in samadhi context, we're maybe noticing things like the parts of the breath as a way of making the breath more interesting, as a way of encouraging the mind to settle and stay on the breath. But our principal interest is in that stability and continuity of attention. By comparison, if we're doing insight, we're investigating, we're inquiring, we're exploring, we're poking and prodding at our experience to see what's going on. So now we really do want to look at the arisings, the passings away. We now want to break the breath down into its subcomponents to see if we can find anything solid. If you're using the same object for both concentration and insight, then you do need sometimes to make a very conscious shift of mental gears from one to the other. Otherwise, you can end up with them kind of getting in the way of each other. So it's important to be clear about this. What am I trying to do right now in my practice? Am I settling and focusing? Am I exploring, investigating? You absolutely can do both with the same object. It's completely fine. But yeah, it's just helpful to be clear about that so that practice doesn't get a bit muddled.